Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the flagrant and cynical use of propaganda by the Trump White House press secretary and by so-called news operations like Fox News, along with the right-wing echo chambers of Sinclair and Limbaugh and his clones, all of whom have become Trump's Pravda, or more Orwellian, his Ministry of Truth. Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and author of How Propaganda Works, joins us to discuss the capture of almost half of the country by a fascist-style propaganda machine similar to what Joseph Goebbels used and Putin uses today. While Trump himself tweets out daily his own fake news to his 40 million Twitter followers, the main support for Trump in post-truth America is orchestrated by Rupert Murdoch and other oligarchs like Bannon's paymasters, the Mercers. They have succeeded in creating an alternative media universe immune to facts and evidence, and they will resort to any lie or manufacture any fiction, no matter how absurd, to keep their president in power and his supporters sealed in a bubble of delusion. Then we'll examine the first of the 12 counts enumerated in the indictment against Paul Manafort, and that is conspiracy against the United States. Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, How Will Donald Trump Respond to the Russian Investigation? We'll look into the challenge facing the reality-based community in this country to convince Trump's base that he chose an exemplar of the Washington swamp to run his campaign, and that when top people in his own party and administration call him an effing moron and are concerned he might blow up the world, they should pay attention. Then finally, we'll assess the overwhelming evidence now apparent that Trump's chief of staff, General John Kelly, is not containing Trump, but is rather completely compatible, if not much further to the right, than the spoiled toddler he supposedly has under adult supervision. American historian Adam Goodhart, the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening, joins us to discuss Kelly's opinions expressed on Fox News that, quote, Robert E. Lee was an honorable man and that the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And joining us now is Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two on epistemology, one on philosophy of language and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. And his latest book is How Propaganda Works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And many people, of course, bring up Adolf Hitler and call people fascists, etc., when they're angry at them. So it's thrown around a lot rather loosely. But let me just violate my own rule here by suggesting that my feeling about what happened yesterday and today in terms of a big news story with the indictments of Paul Manafort and Gates and the revelation of collusion with the Russians from George Papadopoulos, that it's not so much that Hitler has taken over this country, but Joseph Goebbels has. At least he's taken over half of this country.
So let me first speak to the question of fascism. There's a distinction between a fascist state and the fascist tactics in politics. And I think, without a doubt, the Trump campaign and the Trump administration is employing the tactics of fascist governments in their politics. That doesn't mean that they're instituting a system of control. They certainly haven't seized power in the way that Hitler did. But they're nevertheless, without doubt, appealing to a fascist politics. We have the mythic past, making America great again. Hitler wanted to return things to the Holy Roman Empire. We've got fascist propaganda, which you've noticed and we've seen in the past several days. It's a characteristic of fascist politics to spread conspiracy theories. I mean, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the mainstream media is controlled by Jews because they're not reporting on the Jewish conspiracy. So we've got, you know, victimhood, making America great, you know, Merry Christmas. Everyone's going to say Merry Christmas again. We're being victimized by the minorities. So we've got a lot of elements of fascist politics. That doesn't mean we have a fascist government, but they're certainly borrowing a chapter from not just fascist movements in the past, but Eastern Europe, what's happening in say, Poland with the Law and Justice Party. So let's take the parallel there. I mean, what you had there was you had a debunking of the mainstream media because of the Smolensk incident, the plane that crashed in 2010, and they had a plane crash that killed a great number of politicians, and the Law and Justice Party came to power by undermining trust in the mainstream media by saying they're not reporting on the fact that, you know, this was a conspiracy to take this plane down. So you always need to worry about fascist politics when you see this kind of debunking of the media, universities, people saying, you know, people ridiculing them with a kind of sort of ridicule that we see now on Fox News and we see coming from the White House, this kind of complete, you know, just like this conspiracy theory thing where, you know, this whole thing is a conspiracy theory, you know, with Hillary Clinton behind it. This is classic fascist politics, and it's not wrong to use that expression.
Well, it's particularly disconcerting and alarming that it's coming from the podium of the White House and from a public service who our tax dollars pay for. And now arguably, Sarah Huckabee Sanders does a good job in terms of what she's doing for Trump. But the idea that somebody can lie in outrageous and absurd ways consistently and somehow get away with it. And I know the reporters are frustrated because she parries them very well. But at the end of the day, what does it say about this country that from the White House itself, we're getting a stream of lies and absurdities that may be challenged, but certainly continue. And I don't see them paying a penalty. Do you?
No, because the lying is the point. You're assuming that the lying is not the point. The lying is the point, and the open lying and defiance of reality. So you will never get, you know, chapter 18 of Victor Klemperer's book, Language of the Third Reich, is called I Believe in Him. And in it, Klemperer talks about, in 1944, 1945, a soldier's going through the woods, and he's talking to him, and the soldier says, you know, Hitler's got them trapped. Hitler's got them right where he wants them. He said this, and Klemperer said, why do you believe him? And the soldier says, he's never lied to us once, when Hitler had done nothing but lie for the entire 12 years. So Trump's supporters think that, you know, when he says things that are untrue, well, they think it's a corrupt system. It's a corrupt system, so he's exposing the corruption and responding in the only way that you can respond to a corrupt system, which is by playing the same game as them. So the aim of it, the lying is in fact the point. Charles Blow has realized this in the New York Times when he had a piece recently that was like, I think it's not the white supremacy that's at the center, it's the lying. And that's right. All these fascist governments, fascist politics, in fascist politics, the leaders lie because they want to foment, they want to spread this idea that the whole system is corrupt. And so the only way to fight back is to, you know, fight back in kind. And bizarrely, when they do this, they are regarded as actually more honest and trustworthy. Remember, Trump ran an anti-corruption campaign, right? Mm-hmm. When he ran, he campaigned against, quote, crooked Hillary, unquote. I mean, how is that possible that maybe the most corrupt candidate in presidential history, maybe aside from Nixon, but maybe more, ran an anti-corruption campaign? And people think in these circumstances, people not only tolerate lying, they think of it as a sign of honesty.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Stanley, who's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two on epistemology, one in philosophy of language and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. And his latest book is How Propaganda Works. And we are discussing the fact that, boy, does propaganda work. Coming from the White House, from Fox, from Sinclair, from Limbaugh, and half the country, perhaps a little less than half the country, are caught comfortably ensconced in that bubble where they believe Trump. And of course, he's got 40 million Twitter followers. But the point you were just making, though, it's so extraordinary that what the indictment of Paul Manafort is such a kind of laundry list of the most sordid criminality imaginable and greed. And it's just overwhelming. And we know the guy from his history. He's well known in Washington. He was always representing third world thugs like Mobutu, Suharto, Marcos in the Philippines, etc. The ultimate bottom feeding, sleazy Washington lobbyist. If that's not the epitome of the swamp that Trump is supposed to drain, I don't know what is.
But it's characteristic of fascist politics to run these anti-corruption campaigns when you're incredibly corrupt. Putin does the same thing. Putin ran as is constantly, you know, inveighing against corruption when he might be the wealthiest man in the world, as some suspect. You have the same thing in Hungary. You had the mayor of Bob Ford, the mayor of Toronto, also ran an anti-corruption campaign. It was exactly the same in the Third Reich. The Nazi National Socialists were incredibly corrupt. They stole all the wealth of their opponents and Jewish citizens of Germany and Austria. They were extraordinarily corrupt, and yet they ran on anti-corruption, because corruption here, there's really a sort of play on words, right? Because think about the white supremacy. What does corruption really mean? Well, many Americans think that Obama must have been corrupt, because how else? Suddenly you had a black president, and he had this sophisticated black president, and how could that have happened? It was a corruption of the traditional order. So many Americans had this feeling that there was something deeply wrong here. And, of course, with Hillary Clinton, she's a woman. And so the idea that a woman would run for the highest office, it feels like a corruption. Not political corruption, but a corruption of, you know, traditional norms, traditional, you know, of when America was great, when black people knew their place and women knew their place. So,
well, I must say, though, just on touching on Hillary Clinton, of course, this sort of propaganda machine is blaming her for everything, and what they don't blame her for, they blame Obama for. But just yesterday on Fox, Corey Lewandowski, who was the original campaign manager for Trump, was talking about Hillary Clinton, blaming her for everything, but talking about the Clinton administration, not referring to Bill Clinton, but referring to her as though she was actually, there was a Clinton administration. It's amazing. It's as though Clinton won the presidency and somehow Trump is the victim. I mean, you know.
Right, because they have to undermine trust. They have to represent it like there's this corrupt establishment, and they're using any means necessary to go after the corrupt establishment. The kind of politics they're using requires an enemy, and it requires a powerful enemy that you must fear. And so they have to elevate President Obama and Clinton to these enemies who are really behind everything, because that's the only way this kind of politics works. If they create this kind of fear for these, like, shadowy figures who are controlling everything, and then they can undermine faith in the establishment and the very structures of law and order that are going after them.
Well, we know that this chief strategist is no longer there. Steve Bannon is in regular touch with Trump. And basically, there's not much point in talking about Bannon, and people get sort of on the left get hysterical about him, when in fact the real villain is the guy that pays him and funds him, and that's Robert Mercer and his daughter Rebecca, if you want to look at it realistically. So let's look at the people who cynically understand what's happening, they're orchestrating it, they're funding it, they're directing it, and the person who most fits that bill is Rupert Murdoch. He's on the phone almost every day to Donald Trump. There's clearly a strategy behind this propaganda. Yeah. Because yesterday, when the Manafort story broke, what was Fox News talking about? Emojis. So that's not an accident.
Absolutely not.
So to explain, how propaganda is being organized and orchestrated, and what does Rupert Murdoch want out of this?
Well, Rupert Murdoch is playing to some extent the state role of Goebbels, as there are several shot figures here who are trying to create this sort of alternative media empire. So the media messaging. So the idea is there's no uniform news that we can share. The goal in fascist politics is to break your sense of reality. There's no shared reality. So the idea is to create an alternative, entirely alternative reality for the Trump supporters. So when every news show shows the landing on the moon, say, then everyone has a shared reality to which they can refer back. But the goal here is to break that sense of shared reality, to say, look, the people who watch CNN live in a different reality. The news, the big stories, what's relevant is entirely different than what's relevant for you. And so the goal is not, people say, oh, people believe Trump. But I don't think people really care about whether the particular things Sarah Saunders says are true. It's just that there's no shared reality. No one knows what they want to create, a sense that no one knows what to believe, no one knows what's relevant. There's no shared reality. And then everyone is like, okay, people have their different versions. And it's, you win as long as you delegitimize, Mueller and CNN and what the mainstream press is reporting. You don't need to actually establish belief in an alternative reality. You just need to delegitimize the other reality. So that's what's happening. When there's just radically different headlines, you're suggesting that what's relevant for the mainstream press is just relevant because of partisan affiliation and not because it's tracking reality.
But what I find distressing is that, this is what it's doing to journalism and the idea that journalism is under attack and propaganda has taken over at least half of the media spectrum and is on the rise. And I worked on arms control during the Cold War and spent a lot of time in Russia met with a bunch of journalists over there, many of whom worked for the KGB, but, established some friendships, and you felt very sorry for them, that they had to print the party line because they were clearly intelligent people who knew that what they were doing was a bunch of lies on a daily basis, and that was always the joke. Pravda means truth, and TASS means news, and the joke was there's no truth in Pravda and no news in TASS. So the fact that in this country, this the land of the free and the home of the brave, you have volunteer Soviet Pravda types like Murdoch running raw, disgusting propaganda and basically winning over up to half of the population, it seems so deeply un-American, and yet these are the people that claim patriotism. So what's wrong with the Democrats or the political left? Why can't they make the point that this is un-American, this is totalitarianism, and this is unpatriotic? By the way, stealing an election, having Putin steal our election, ought to be considered an offense, and yet these patriots in the Republican Party won't even talk about it. And by the way, a bunch of people on the left like Oliver Stone and Katrina VandenHeuvel are equally in denial.
Well, they're not in denial. I think RT cultivates both people on the far left and people on the right. They want that. They want, because it destabilizes you. If there's no shared sense, if you've got people, RT will give platforms to people to Occupy Wall Street, and they'll give platforms to Richard Spencer, because that destabilizes things, and then people will just look to a strong man to give them a sense of stability. But I don't think you should. I think Trump actually is very clever in the sense that when he's pressed on this, he will point out that it's not actually such a break from the past. Look at, as Trump himself says, look at what happened during the Iraq War when the newspapers did lie to us. So throughout the United States, if you look at sort of the reporting on crime, for instance, as crime was dropping through the 1990s, you had these lurid racist portrayals of what was happening that led to massive increases in incarceration. So I don't think it's so not American. I mean, from the Vietnam War to the Iraq War, we've had to uncritical reporting on the financial crisis. This didn't come out of the blue. And now there is some kind of break when it comes from the White House, but it came from the White House, and I don't think we should absolve the Bush administration or the Obama administration with some of the banking stuff. So there are precedents, but it's just become, it seems to have turned a corner where there's an attempt to completely delegitimize, you know, to say, look, I mean, Fox News has been doing this for quite some time, way far before Trump, has been saying, look, you've got your news, we've got our news. There's no alternative facts, like we have our own reality, you have your reality, there's no shared reality. You know, you go talk about your reality and, you know, and say what's important to you, and that's fine, you're on the other team. And that's the goal, to like destroy reality. And that's why people don't blame Trump or the Trump administration for lying, because the very concept of lying presupposes a notion of reality. And there is no reality now. There's just spectacle. There's just amusement. It's just, wow, what's going to happen next? I saw a tweet saying, do you realize if the alleged video of the alleged incident in Russia with the president came out, it would be a two-day news story at most, you know?
Right. So, well, but when I use the word un-American, and everything you said is absolutely true, that we don't have a leg to stand on, and we've been lied to constantly by all kinds of governments. But still, the Founding Father, particularly Jefferson, was very aware of that and made the point that he'd prefer a free press over any government at the end of the day if he had to choose. And whether or not he said this or not, it's hard to know, but that information is the oxygen of democracy. So that's where I get this notion that it seems so un-American, because we do have this idea of the First Amendment, the free press, and, you know, the Fourth Estate.
But First Amendment, this is what Russia realized, their political technologists, like Surkov, they realized you could use free speech against itself. And Goebbels. Goebbels famously said, one of the greatest jokes of democracy is that its freedoms were used by its worst enemies to defeat it. Free speech is being used. I mean, you know, they're not saying CNN isn't allowed. I mean, Trump does sometimes say that, but generally they're not saying CNN isn't allowed their version of reality. They're saying, no, there's no such thing as reality. We're going to give you our version of reality, and, you know, there's just different realities to choose from. And that's what happened when Russia Today became RT. They just decided they would represent every view, and they put conspiracy theories right there with, like, basic news. And when you do that, people lose their grip on reality. So free speech is actually, I mean, remember that Trump rallies are called free speech rallies, because people want, and the whole idea is, and then ironically they're attacking universities, the last bastion of genuine free speech, for being anti-free speech. So free speech is complex, because it's being used as a weapon right now. It's being used to force journalists to talk about conspiracy theories. You know, why don't you, what about Hillary Clinton and uranium? How come you're not talking about that? You know, they're trying, so it's tricky. What they're doing is they're undermining basic trust in each other and in the democratic institutions. They're not really undermining free speech yet.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. I'm sure you can tell that I'm very frustrated that they're getting away with this.
You have every right to be, and what you're doing is what we ought to be doing, which is trying to break it down and fight back.
Well, again, I thank you very much for joining us, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of four books, two on epistemology, one on philosophy, language, and semantics, and one in social and political philosophy. And his latest book is How Propaganda Works. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the challenge facing the reality-based majority in this country to convince Trump's base that he chose an exemplar of the Washington swamp to run his campaign.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians.
from Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Last Great Nazi War Criminal Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, How Will Donald Trump Respond to the Russia Investigation? Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Oh, thanks, Ian. Always glad to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Lawrence, but we already know how he's responding. He's trashing George Papadopoulos, who he once said was an excellent guy, and now he's calling him a liar. So that's the MO.
Well, I mean, it's the script that Trump always follows, so there's nothing surprising about that. I mean, it's certainly, I mean, we've seen it before that he can praise a person to the sky one day and then turn around and bury the dagger in the back and engage in the kind of worst sort of libel and you know, personal attacks on a person. At least he didn't mention Papadopoulos's height.
Right, or his
we have some things to be grateful for.
Right, or his Cypriot origins or anything.
Yes, exactly.
But what Papadopoulos has brought to the table is such an echo of that meeting that took place in Trump Tower with the Russian lawyer Veselnitskaya and a bunch of other Russian intelligence people. This looks like the approach that he made to the campaign, and we don't know how far it went, but we know that in April they were talking about with this intermediary, this Maltese so-called professor who works for the FSB, that they had all of this data, which was later dumped several months later by WikiLeaks. So it's hard to believe that the campaign didn't use that stuff in the interregnum.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it's, I mean, you have this this conversation that Papadopoulos has with this professor in April of 2016. Of course, the meeting at Trump Tower takes place then in June 2016. And of course, also kind of connecting the dots with the way Mueller's investigation is unfolding. We, of course, know that Manafort was present at the June 2016 meeting. And of course, the other thing that's of interesting to speculate on is in as much as Papadopoulos has pled guilty to lying. So in that sense, you know, I suppose Trump is accurate. He is a liar. I mean, he confessed to that. But it will be very interesting to find out, as I guess we will in the coming days or months or weeks, what kind of information he then supplied. That is, what kind of other contacts that he had. I mean, presumably he made a plea deal and then presented Mueller with other... He spoke to Mueller. I mean, he probably presumably spoke to him at length.
So he's obviously... Mueller is going to question Sam Clovis.
Yes,
who Papadopoulos reported to and who suggested he go off to meet with this Russian FSB asset, the Maltese professor, who's not, in fact, a professor.
The professor in scare quotes.
Right.
My favorite type of academic.
You mean your competition?
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, I mean, it's obvious that when you look at this laundry list of crimes of the indictment of Manafort, it lays out, it's just extraordinary. And I talked to a Swedish diplomat who knew him very well in Ukraine and has followed him quite closely and is very, very well informed. And it's just breathtaking what a crook the guy is. And of course, that flies in the whole face of draining the swamp. If anybody epitomized the swamp, it was Manafort.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole notion that we're going to, you know, I guess there are all sorts of great ironies with respect to the claims that Trump made about the presidency and the reality of that presidency. But certainly the draining the swamp is one of, you know, it's in that top 10,000 ironies of, you know, statements that no longer seem to be kind of an accurate reflection of reality. I mean, Michael Flynn, all these people, I mean, they're kind of walking toxic Superfund sites.
Well, it could get worse, though, in terms of indictments against Manafort, in as much as, again, Anders Aslan, who had on yesterday, the Swedish diplomat, who knows him and spent an awful lot of time in Ukraine, particularly during the time that when Manafort was there. He made the point that Manafort stuck with Yanukovych, Putin's guy, way past everybody else had ditched him. But he stuck with him all the way through, and all the way through his eventual, you know, people power coup against him. And
right.
By the end, Manafort was about the last person that Yanukovych had, literally talking to him. Manafort was there when Yanukovych's special forces bodyguards opened fire on the crowds and killed about 140 Ukrainian citizens.
Right. Also bear in mind, of course, that Manafort is probably helping to agitate people to, you know, throw stones at, like, American soldiers.
Right, but if somebody can look into that, then he's got real blood on his hand, apart from being a mega crook.
Right, no, certainly. Certainly that's the case. Though I do think that, you know, Mueller is probably trying to throw the book at Manafort, not because he's, in the first instance, interested in prosecuting him for these crimes. He's interested in flipping him. And that's why I think it was also telling that the Manafort indictment is revealed precisely on the same day that Mueller announces this plea deal with Papadopoulos, because I think one signal that sends is to Manafort that here we're playing real hardball with you. We have you in a very, very difficult position, and but, you know, talking, cooperating pays its dividends. And I think that's really what they're trying to do, is to try to flip him.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, How Will Donald Trump Respond to the Russia Investigation? But there is clearly, in apart from the fact that there's a lot more probably that you could nail Manafort with, and I'm sure he's trying to flip him, but based upon what Manafort's lawyer said yesterday, it almost seemed like out of the gate, Manafort's lawyer was representing Trump. And the first thing he said was, you know, this just proves that Donald Trump is innocent. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But,
right.
But so in these cases, who pays the lawyers? And I believe Manafort's run up a massive bill and he's kind of broke. Do you think the... I mean, the one person who I think has already been flipped because he's so silent is General Flynn, Michael Flynn.
Yes, that's probably true. And in the case of Manafort, it's very difficult to predict his behavior. I mean, as you point out, it's possible that if Trump supporters or people close to Trump are paying for his legal fees, that creates its own kind of loyalty. On the other hand, if what he's looking at is, regardless of the quality of that lawyering, he's looking at a very, very substantial prison sentence, then I think his gratitude towards the deep pockets paying for his legal fees, I think that gratitude will be pretty shallow.
Well, isn't he looking, I mean, let's face it, that indictment, you know, what they say you could indict a ham sandwich. In this case, based upon that indictment, this guy is toast. He's going to spend decades in
Yes, that's what he's looking at, right? Unless he works out some kind of deal.
Right.
Right. So, and again, that's the thing that, I mean, in a sense, that's kind of exactly a prosecutor's dream. I mean, they want to have someone in that position where they say, look, either you're spending a good deal of your natural life in prison, or you cooperate with us.
And that's already happened with Papadopoulos.
I mean, clearly with Papadopoulos. Yeah, and again,
but he's only facing 5 years.
That's right. In his case, he wasn't even facing a substantial nothing right. like the kind of yeah. prison term that Manafort's looking at. And nonetheless, Papadopoulos saw the light.
So isn't there a strange kind of coincidence here between sons-in-laws and father-in-laws? We know that Jared Kushner has, when he was courting Ivanka, in order to impress her, he bought this ridiculous building, 666 Fifth Avenue, way overpriced just before the market, Wall Street, crashed in 2008. He has a $1.2 billion balloon payment due at the end of next year. He's not going to make it. He's using his office, by the way, running around the world raising money from MBS, his buddy, the boy king in Saudi Arabia, and shaking down other people for money. There's a whole other story there. But the point is that if you look at what Jared is doing vis-a-vis his father-in-law, who it's very much a mirror of what happened with Manafort. Manafort was pretty much broke because he lost Yanukovych. And then he apparently, all this money that the Russians loaned him, etc., somehow he went through that largely because his son-in-law out here in Los Angeles got into real estate and apparently is, you know, a crook and an incompetent, which I think is pretty much the case with Jared as well. And apparently Manafort had to bail his son-in-law out because, you know, the son-in-law, you know, ripped off Dustin Hoffman and a bunch of other people out here for millions of dollars. It seems like we're talking about crime families, the Trumps and the Manaforts, for God's sake.
And it adds a whole different wrinkle to the notion of the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, because in this case, the apple is the son-in-law instead of the son. But it is very interesting how those kind of strange ties of corruption now seem to extend across families.
Right, and Jared just had a secret trip to Saudi Arabia to meet with his buddy MBS, supposedly to solve the Middle East peace, which, in case you hadn't noticed, has been lots of ships have run aground on the shoals of those expectations.
Oh, now, Ian, I'm sure he's going to solve that in the next few days.
Right, but what I was going to mention is that he took along his brother, who runs the family real estate company, the ones that have got the $1.2 billion balloon payment looming. So that would suggest to me that they weren't necessarily talking about Israeli-Palestinian peace, but they're talking about how to get someone to bail them out with deep pockets.
Right.
But back to Manafort. What's your sense then? Just preceding you, I was speaking with Jason Stanley at Yale. He wrote the book, How Propaganda Works. And clearly propaganda is working. We are in an alternative universe. You and I are in the reality-based universe that Trump derides all the time as fake news. He's doing incredibly well with his people who believe him and don't believe anything that the mainstream press do. And you do have a shocking situation where from the White House podium, you have a public servant who our tax dollars are paying, lying with absurd, ridiculous, transparent lies. You have Fox News lying. You have Sinclair lying. You have Limbaugh and the whole chorus of them lying like crazy and trying to pin everything on Hillary Clinton. And it is apparently working in their universe. So in the showdown between the reality community and the Trump bubble, who's going to win?
You know, it's a fascinating question because, you know, I do think that on some level, assuming that Mueller is able to build a very substantial case that shows, if not active collusion, then at the very least that Trump engaged in obstruction of justice. That seems like the clearer charge, at least in at this stage of the game, though it's certainly very possible that his son and other close confidants, if not he himself, engaged in collusion. But if he builds a very strong case, then I really do think that we're heading towards some kind of, you know, real constitutional crisis, because I don't see Trump permitting that to go forward. I mean, he's going to do something. We know that his instincts are to engage in, you know, tenacious gestures of self-preservation and to always go on the attack. And that's just who wants to think about that? Who wants to kind of think about that kind of constitutional crisis, especially when it will, you know, come down to these invertebrates in the Republican Party to ultimately check him in his campaign to undermine our entire 200-plus year constitutional order.
So do you expect then an attempt, or actually he doesn't have to attempt, he's got the power to pardon Manafort, he can do it preemptively, as he did with Sheriff Arpaio?
Yeah, I don't even know if the pardon is going to work. You know, because one thing that is interesting, and this goes back a little bit to the point that you're making about the multiple charges that Manafort is facing, it's also possible that Manafort could be indicted on state criminal charges rather than just federal criminal charges. And Trump's pardon power does not extend to state charges. So, you know, who knows if the state charges actually how they would be coordinated with the Mueller investigation. So it's hard to actually figure that out. But my concern would be less with the pardoning of Manafort than with, you know, he's described Mueller as engaged in a witch hunt. And, you know, if he continues to have his base believing it's a witch hunt, and if he feels that the circle is tightening, I could easily imagine him some point, even though it would be, we're looking at kind of a world of hurt, of firing Mueller.
Well, let me just quote from your article in the Guardian, Lawrence Douglas, how will Donald Trump respond to the Russia investigation? Just at the end here, you sum it up. This is a president who has been called an effing moron by his own Secretary of State. He's been accused of having the discipline of a spoiled toddler and being so intemperate that he could trigger a nuclear war. Charges that come not from the people's enemies in the mainstream news, but from within his own party and administration. Now, while that is absolutely true, it goes back to my earlier question, is what is going to break that bubble? If Trump supporters, we know they won't believe anything the mainstream press says, but why don't they believe what people who have interacted with Trump on a daily basis trying to tell us? Why won't they believe that? And at what point will they believe it? And finally, what will it take for them to believe it? Do we have to see the PP tape?
Yeah, exactly. It's something like that. I mean, I do think it is something where, I guess one thing that we should also point out is at the same time that he seems to be able to draw on the support of a base that is willing to support him in the face of overwhelming evidence of malfeasance, incompetence, absolute unsuitability for performing the job of president. The other thing I'm supposed to point out is this is an incredibly weak president, you know, by historical standards. I mean, he is not someone who can draw upon, he can draw upon the support of this fervid base. I'm just not sure that that's going to save him in the long term, but at the same time, I'm also not sure that his removal would that we'd be spared some kind of really, really, really ugly constitutional crisis if we were to move in that direction.
Right, and if he were removed and it wasn't absolutely ironclad, then he'd be running around the country fomenting revolution. So,
of course, exactly. Yeah. Him and Steve Bannon.
Well, Lawrence Douglas, let's keep in touch here and hope for the best. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I mean, speaking with Lawrence Douglas, who's a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His most recent book is The Right Wrong Man, John Demjanjuk and the Last Great Nazi War Crimes Trial. And he has an article at The Guardian, How Will Donald Trump Respond to the Russia Investigation? I'm going to take a brief station break and back assessing the overwhelming evidence now apparent that Trump's chief of staff, General John Kelly, is not containing Trump, but is rather completely compatible, if not much further to the right, than the spoiled toddler he supposedly has under adult supervision. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adam Goodhart, who's an historian, essayist, and journalist, who is director of Washington College's CV Star Center for the Study of the American Experience. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times acclaimed Civil War series Disunion, and is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Goodhart.
Good to be here.
And clearly we are talking because Chief of Staff of the White House, General John Kelly, was on Fox News on Monday evening for the inauguration of Laura Ingraham's new show, and he offered his opinion on the Civil War in the context of Confederate monuments, and expressed the idea that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man and that the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. That's created quite a stir amongst historians. So you're a Civil War historian. Are you upset?
I don't know if upset is exactly the right word. More sort of amused. You know, it's funny because as historians, we're always saying that we would like our political leaders to think about history and take history into consideration with the decisions that they make and talk about history in our public life. And then as soon as they actually do, it's often something that's so wince-producing, as in this case, that you sort of wish they had just shut up and kept their mouths shut in the first place. So this is definitely one that's, I would say, wince-producing at best, and it's wrong on so many different levels.
Well, to give the full quote, this is what Kelly said last night on Laura Ingraham's new show on Fox News. "I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of ability to compromise led to the Civil War, and men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand." Now, I must say, good people on both sides has an awful, uncomfortable echo of Donald Trump's recent remarks about the Nazis in Charlottesville.
It certainly is. And I think clearly with the monuments, we have to separate the individual people from the cause that they were fighting for, and I think that we can talk about the individual leaders as well of that movement without necessarily indicting every single person who was involved in any way. I mean, people have many different reasons for going to war. We see that in every war, and was every last human being who was involved with the Confederate States of America an evil human being? Well, as a historian, I believe in degrees of subtlety, and I'm not ready to make that dismissal. But I do think that there's no question that the Confederate cause was an evil cause, and everybody who fought in the service of it was fighting for a cause that was wrong and evil and literally murderous. And I would call it terrorist. When you think about Robert E. Lee, he killed more Americans, more members of the U.S. Army and Navy than Osama bin Laden or the Taliban could ever have dreamed of. 750,000 people died in the Civil War, about half of them Union. So think of that on the scale of 9/11. Several hundred 9/11s, and you get a sense of just what scale that treachery caused death on.
But have you ever been able to figure out the mindset that comes along with this revisionist history of, you know, that came out during Jim Crow, and the idea, and it's sort of been, and that's when all these Civil War monuments were erected, and this whole sort of nostalgic idea of the noble lost cause. I never could understand, though, and it perpetuates largely amongst sort of the heirs, if you will, of the very people who fought for the Confederacy, and they were poor white farmers, blacksmiths, cobblers, you name it, fighting ultimately for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves.
Well, I think that there are a few different questions here, and to address the first one first about when this was initiated and how it was perpetuated, I feel pretty strongly that although most of those monuments are located in the South, some of them are located in the North, we can't talk about this as a Southern problem, and we can't say that this is something that white Southerners have to solve. This is something in which white Northerners were also deeply complicit. This is a problem of the United States of America, that after the war, there was this question of, as there is in many civil wars and many civil conflicts, whether you look at Nicaragua or South Africa or Iraq, when the fighting starts to die down, there's this question of, okay, well, do we want to hold the grudges or do we want to try to let them go? And in the United States, as in many post-Civil War nations, there was a decision made by a lot of people, or a lot of people favored sort of letting it go and embracing forgiveness and welcoming the prodigal brothers and sisters of the Confederacy, as they saw it, back into the American fold. And this was really Northerners, white Northerners, as much as it was white Southerners. But there was also something that was darker at work there, and that has to do with the role of African Americans in this new post-Civil War America. Lincoln, of course, during the war, had promised a new birth of freedom. That's what a lot of people thought that the United States was getting, including millions of African Americans had high hopes for that new birth. And instead, over the 15 years or so after the end of the Civil War, well, it was something that really continued and perhaps even still continues, but there was a decision made to sort of abandon largely the struggle for black civil rights in favor of a kind of reunion among white Northerners and Southerners. And that really is what sparked this whole idea that, well, even if we're Northerners, white Northerners who supported the Union cause, we can still admire Robert E. Lee and embrace him even as an American hero. I think that's what was motivating that movement.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Goodhart, a historian, essayist, and journalist, who is the director of the Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. And he's a regular columnist for the New York Times acclaimed Civil War series Disunion and the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Well, of course, the decision, the remarks by General Kelly, Trump's chief of staff, came up in the context of a question from Laura Ingram about a decision of a church in Alexandria, Virginia, to remove a plaque honoring Robert E. Lee. So that was the context. But just give me your take on my puzzlement, because you have the South today, politically rather feudal still, right to work, etc. And my sense is that it's still that sort of mentality that seemed to explain, or not explain, but at least raise the question of why were these poor white Southern farmers, etc., fighting for the plantation owner's right to replace them with slaves?
Well, slavery is, of course, a different thing from white supremacy. And while only a minority of Southern whites before the Civil War were actually slaveholders themselves, the system of white supremacy is one that all whites in the South really were invested in. This idea that there was a class of people sort of on the very bottom of society socioeconomically who prevented the poor whites from being in that class. And some people even argue that that's sort of what made American democracy possible. That's what made it possible for slaveholders like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to say that America could be a republic with broad suffrage, of course, not universal suffrage even among whites in those early days, but that there could be broad suffrage because you were writing out that bottom rung. You were excluding what in Europe would have been the peasant class, and these were African Americans. America was really founded on white supremacy in so many ways, and it was white supremacy that continued to build the economy of the South, and in many ways the economy of the North, before, during, and after the Civil War. It was African Americans who provided the labor that literally built these colonies and then states. So, of course, that's a reason that white Southerners were deeply invested in white supremacy and deeply invested in the Confederate cause.
So white workers weren't in competition with black slaves for jobs?
No, far from it. Well, you know, what we think of as jobs wasn't really a concept in the 1840s or 50s or 60s. These were farmers. These were artisans. And, you know, I don't think we're talking about a labor market in the sense that we would think about a labor market today.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's easy to point out ways that their interests didn't coincide with those of the planter class. And the planter class really did want to set up a system that was more oligarchical in many ways, even than the pre-Civil War South had been, and consolidate the power of these quote-unquote aristocratic elites. But they played the white supremacy card very skillfully. As I would argue, many politicians on the right, including Donald Trump and those around him, continue to do today.
Well, I think that is at the heart of the struggle in America today is whether the democracy will survive the plutocracy. How much we have become a plutocracy. But just in closing, though, let me get to what's always been a real disconnect, and that is the Constitution itself, Jefferson and all, with the lofty language, all men are created equal, and they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That obviously did not apply to the slaves, and they represented billions and billions of value to the Southern planters. They tried to finesse it by saying that blacks were three-fifths of a person. George Mason refused to sign the Declaration of Independence for that reason, I believe. He thought that they were trying to finesse something that couldn't be finessed and eventually come back to bite you, and it did with the Civil War. Is that a accurate thumb sketch of
I think in most ways that's quite accurate. They kicked the can down the road for a couple of generations and found ways not to deal with the fundamental problem of slavery, the fundamental contradictions of American democracy when you proclaimed universal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, while at the same time denying it to millions of people who were living alongside you. And I think that paradox was really recognized. Lots of people tried to justify it in various ways, but it was impossible to ignore. And so when John Kelly says that the Civil War happened because of a failure to compromise, really it happened because compromises were made for the better part of a century. And then and finally those compromises themselves led to a completely untenable situation.
Well, Adam Goodhart, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Goodhart, who's an historian, essayist, and journalist, who is director of Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times acclaimed Civil War series, Disunion, and is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.